So how can he then come in and say that his comments later than the police comments could not have prejudiced the proceeding? So yes, it is absolutely clear from the record that his very purpose was to prejudice the proceeding.
He could have had his secretary do this, though, right? Or he could have had the investigator that he had look into this have a press conference.
Well, actually, Justice Scalia...
Would that have been all right under the rule?
Well, Nevada Supreme Court Rule 203 provides that it's professional misconduct for a lawyer to violate any rule through the acts of another.
Through the acts of... So he couldn't have anybody do it.
Well, it would be extremely difficult, let me say, as a practical matter, to prove a violation that a lawyer was somehow setting up a process whereby somebody else was violating the rule. I don't know of a single case in which a lawyer has ever been disciplined for prejudicial pretrial publicity from someone else, but it could happen, and indeed...
Do the ABA rules contain the same... Proposals contain the same provision, or is that of Nevada's own creation?
The ABA rule, Model Rule 8.4A, contains the same in substance provision. Let me also say that from the prosecutor's standpoint, Rule 179.5 provides that the prosecutor must exercise reasonable care to prevent investigators, law enforcement personnel, employees, and other persons from making statements that would be prohibited by Rule 177. That is incorporated in Model Rule 3.8.
Well, could Sanders have hired a public relations person who's not a lawyer to make all these statements?
Yes, I think he could have. We would.
Could the state prohibit that conduct?
It would be more difficult, we would think. As the questions of the court to Mr. Tiger reflect, and as our position makes clear, there is something unique and special about the role of a lawyer as an officer of the court. And it would be much more difficult to try to deal with the conduct of outsiders or third parties. And certainly the bar would not try to...
Do you think that the public is influenced by a defense lawyer saying that his client is innocent?
Well, Justice Marshall, much more than that was said at the press conference. In fact,
would you answer the question?
I think that in some circumstances, depending on how it's said, it could have an effect. Now, here, in fact, he didn't just say,
Do you expect the defense counsel to admit he's defending a guilty man?
No, but here's the
Do
point.
You?
No, but here's the point, and it was established by this court in the United States against Young. There's a difference in saying, my client is, you know, the evidence will show that my client is innocent versus actually vouching for innocence. Now, what Mr. Gentile did here is he went so far as to say, this is the first time I have ever held a press conference, and the reason I did so is because I believe in this case that my client is innocent.
Well, you think that the average person is influenced by by anything a defense counsel says in a press conference?
I do think so. Yes,
you do.
This was the whole thrust of this court's opinion in Shepard. In 1966, this court in Shepard against Maxwell identified pretrial publicity as being a problem of extraordinary magnitude and in essence instructed the bar to go out and do something to correct the problem. That ultimately led first to the disciplinary rule.
The case of the Bar Association doing it.
This is a Nevada...
You recognize that they're two different situations?
Well, these rules are Nevada Supreme Court rules. They were adopted by the court, Your Honor.
Couldn't the court have adopted the same thing in Nevada, put on a gag rule?
The problem with the gag
couldn't
rule...
Couldn't that have been done?
Yes or no?
In this case,
no, because at the time the statements were made, there had not even been an appearance before the judge who was going to try the case. There are enormous problems with the gag order, if I could just go through those. Number one, if the gag order is required to comport with Mr.
Tiger's... Well, I mean, this other one is much easier. You don't have to go through anything.
Well, the whole purpose, Your Honor, of professional standards is to identify conduct that lawyers should hold themselves to. It's no different. You could have a case-by-case determination of attorney-client privilege, and you could say that it's okay to disclose client confidences unless in a particular case a judge orders you not to. That would be cumbersome, and it really wouldn't make sense as a matter of procedure. The whole reason that you have disciplinary rules is because lawyers are to be held to certain standards. And these standards ought to apply, we submit, in every case. But let me go on further with the problems of the gag order situation. One problem with a gag order is that you're not going to be dealing with all those other situations in which there's pretrial publicity. Even if a gag order is entered, you're going to have myriad appeals, briefing. The Levine case, which Mr. Tiger cites in his reply brief, is a perfect example where you have a mandamus appeal, extraordinary briefing on that case, and ultimately what the Ninth Circuit ended up doing was imposing a gag order that's virtually identical to Model Rule 3.6. So what you're going to end up having in any event, probably from the gag order situation, is courts adopting rules very similar to 3.6.
Mr. Klonoff, I guess if every lawyer went around saying, I really believe, honest, deep in my soul, that my client is innocent, the public might be affected by the lawyer who can't say that.
Well,
you know, the press asks him, do you really believe deep down in your soul that your client is innocent? And he says, no comment. That might be...
Well, that's true. Let me...
It'd be sort of hard to defend guilty people, wouldn't it?
Well, but there is a difference. United States against Young has made clear in admonishing both the prosecutor and the defense lawyer in that case that it is misconduct to vouch for your client's innocence if you're the defense lawyer or if you're the prosecutor to say you...
And that's the reason, isn't it? Because if you do that, the lawyer who can't do it is prejudicing his client.
Absolutely. But and let me say one thing further with respect to all these comments about the vouching. The principal ground upon which the Nevada Supreme Court relied and the ground that the bar thinks is the most egregious from the standpoint of this press conference is not the fact that Mr. Gentile said, I believe my client is innocent. Rather, it is the several pages of the press conference, starting on page 8A of the petitioner's appendix, where he talks about the cover-up, about the fact that 1, 2, 4 of the victims are drug dealers, convicted money launderers, known drug dealers, didn't say a word about anything until they were approached by Metro and after they were already in trouble trying to work themselves out of something. On and on about the character, credibility, and reputation of the government's witnesses. No one, I submit, who studied Model Rule 3.6 or Rule 177 the night before could have believed reasonably that those kinds of comments were permitted under the rule. Mr. Tiger has made a big point out of the fact that his client studied the rule the night before, but I would submit that no reasonable lawyer could have concluded that those types of comments were proper.
Mr. Klonoff, is the second part of Rule 177 typical of state bar rules around the country?
It is, Your Honor. The bar rule that Nevada has is verbatim for Model Rule 3.6, which is the rule in the vast majority of jurisdictions.
Which laid that creates sort of a presumption that if the statement relates to credibility of a witness or guilt or innocence of a defendant in a criminal case.
Let me say, they're not presumptions in an evidentiary sense. What they are guidelines. They're things that ordinarily would cause prejudice. And
Have they been operated in Nevada as a sort of presumption, do you think?
Not as an evidentiary presumption. The way they have applied both in Nevada and in courts around the country is exactly what they are. They're guidance, but the burden is still on the bar in a particular case to show by clear and convincing evidence that there was a substantial likelihood of material prejudice. And that is the standard.
And you think that was done here, notwithstanding the Nevada Supreme Court's finding that there was no actual prejudice?
Oh, absolutely. There's a clear difference between a substantial likelihood of prejudice and actual prejudice. If a court or bar were to adopt an actual prejudice standard, it could largely nullify the rule. For example, take a situation in which there's a press conference that everyone would concede is just outrageous. It's dealing with all kinds of prejudicial information. And then for some reason the indictment is dismissed or a guilty plea is entered. You would have a situation there where the argument would be made there was no actual prejudice because the indictment was dismissed or there was no trial or whatever. You can't have a rule that focuses on actual prejudice. You have to look at the time the statement is made in order to assess whether or not there's a violation.
Do you think the case In re Primus speaks at all to the standard we should employ?
We think that the standard, Your Honor, in terms of the balancing test, there's really two parts to the question. Number one, what is the balancing test that gets you to the standard? And we'd submit that that's the Seattle Times pecuniae test that we set out on page 25.
Well, I asked you, though, about In re Primus, which I thought did concern discipline of an attorney. Did it not?
Yes, it did. And the Primus standard is certainly relevant, as is the Orlick standard. Let me note, petitioner in his reply brief at page 4 agrees with the Nevada Bar in terms of the operative standard. They too recite the pecuniary standard as enunciated in Seattle Times. If I can return, Justice O'Connor, to your question, these guidelines that are set out in the rule are really one of the great virtues of the rule. Petitioner in his brief goes on at length trying to criticize these guidelines, but in fact, this was an extraordinary effort of the Bar over many years, guided, in fact, by this court's decision in Shepard against Maxwell, not only to set a substantial likelihood of prejudice standard, but to do so in a way that lawyers will really understand what is permitted and what is not permitted. And indeed, I would refer this court to page 28 of our brief, footnote 28, where we quote at length this court's Shepard versus Maxwell decision, and the court will see that many of the guidelines set out in part 2 of the rule were taken almost verbatim from Shepard. By the same token, the third part of the rule is designed to provide a safe harbor, to let a lawyer know that in certain circumstances he doesn't have to fear any possibility of discipline so long as he doesn't go outside of those parameters. Now, let me return to the implications of the standard that's urged by petitioner. It's interesting, as the argument is made in his brief, it's a clear and present danger press standard, but as the argument has been made today in response to virtually every difficult hypothetical that this court could propose, such as judges, such as court employees, Mr. Tiger ran from that standard, and we would submit, as we said in our brief, that if the clear and present danger Nebraska press standard were held to apply to lawyers, you would ultimately have precisely what was indicated by that questioning and answer. You'd have a dilution of the Nebraska press standards because courts would not want to hold officers of the court to the same standards that apply to the press. The Nebraska press standard we submit is entirely appropriate for the press. It is necessary for a free and vigorous press. But the standard we would submit has no application whatsoever in the context of lawyers. Just to give a few examples, further the examples that Mr. Tiger has given, under the clear and present danger standard, presumably, a defense lawyer could go out, call a press conference, and announce that he believes his client is guilty. As long as it's done before trial, he could do that and he could not be disciplined, because all you need to do is conduct searching voir dire, have a change of venue, or one of the other devices. Now, no one would reasonably submit that it would be permissible for a lawyer in a situation like that to go out and announce to the press that his client is guilty. The same thing applies.
I'm not saying I disagree with part two of the rule, but I'm not sure why that part really refers to matters that are ordinarily likely to have the effect of a substantial likelihood of materially prejudicing an adjudicative proceeding. For example, why is it limited? It is ordinarily likely to have such an effect when it refers to a criminal matter, and the statement relates to. Is there any limitation on what a lawyer can say with respect to civil proceedings?
Well, the limitation takes you back into subsection 1.
All section 2 covers is criminal matters. Is that right?
No, it covers civil.
Does it cover civil as well? I just have the excerpt of it here.
It's a statement referred to in subsection 1 ordinarily is likely to have such an effect when it refers to a civil matter triable to a jury, a criminal matter, or any other proceeding that could result in incarceration. So,
if it's a civil matter triable to a judge, it doesn't make any difference, and lawyers can do...
We concede
pretty much anything unless it's likely to influence the judge, which it shouldn't, right?
We concede in our brief that it would be extraordinarily difficult to violate the rule in the context of a bench trial because of all the jurisprudence suggesting that judges are thick-skinned and that they're different. It's not inconceivable, however, and that's why there is that rule to deal with extraordinary situations. Cox versus Louisiana, the court did, in the context of that case, recognize that even judges could, in some circumstances, be prejudiced. But the rule... And the presumption, the guidelines in Part 2 are a reflection of that very common sense premise that ordinarily you would not be able to have that kind of prejudice.
Let me go back to Justice Souter's hypothetical for a moment then. So assume a sequestered jury. Does the rule not apply to anything that might be said on television during a trial then?
Well, we heard that Mr. Tiger's rule does not apply.
No, I mean, what is your view of this rule?
Our rule is that it very well could. That there could
and why? Because of what state interest? Because the jury is safe from hearing what's said.
Well, studies have shown that in sequestration situations, juries aren't always safe from hearing that. Sometimes they do get news.
But you would rely on the possibility that the information would get to the jury, even in that situation.
That would be one theory, and Justice Souter has talked about the whole dignity of the court
but
process.
That's what I'm really asking. Are you relying on that
that
dignity?
Well, that would be one aspect of it. The court in Levine, the case.
If that's the theory, why do you even need a substantial likelihood of prejudice to the trial?
Well,
why is the prejudice to the dignity of the profession and so forth enough?
Well, it doesn't say the trial. Actually, the way that the rule is worded, it actually is broader so that it doesn't cover just the outcome of the trial.
Likelihood
of materially prejudicing a proceeding. It prejudicing the dignity of the proceeding. It doesn't say prejudice the outcome of the trial. And in fact, the Ninth Circuit in the Levine case, the case Mr. Tiger cited as adopting a Nebraska press standard, gagged the lawyers in the Richard Miller case precisely. Because of that reason.
Let me just be sure I understand one other thing. Does this rule only apply to lawyers who are representing parties to pending litigation? What about the lawyer who volunteers to go on the TV show and give a running commentary on the case?
The rule as applied in Nevada and as far as we know in all other jurisdictions only applies to the lawyer involved in the case. And the reason we say that, number one, that's the reference in Part 3 of the rule. Number two, the disciplinary rule that preceded it, which was more restrictive of lawyer speech than this rule, the disciplinary rule on its face was clearly limited to lawyers involved in a proceeding. It would be very difficult, for example, to have this rule apply to commentary by Arthur Miller appearing on Good Morning America.
Right.
And the Nevada Bar and the Nevada Supreme Court are not trying to do that. They're trying to get at the lawyer who's an officer of the court in a pending proceeding.
On the question of the dignity of the court, suppose the defense counsel or trial counsel proves it to the jury to its satisfaction everything that he said in the press conference. Doesn't that vindicate the dignity of the court?
That does not, and that in fact gets me back to a point.
Because this is very important. I assume you would suggest that it's constitutional to have a rule saying if an officer of the court, an attorney in pending litigation, cannot say anything which prejudices the dignity of the court.
Well, it would have to be a substantial likelihood of materially prejudicing.
A substantial likelihood of materially prejudicing the dignity of the court.
Yeah. I must say, however, that...
And would you conclude that any statement that reveals the testimony that's going to be brought forth in the court offends the dignity of the court?
No, I don't think so. You'd have to look at the...
What are the instances which you are trying to prohibit? Give me some examples of what would be prohibited by the dignity of the court rule.
Well, it would have to be in a very extreme situation. I know of only one case that has gone off on that ground, and that's the Levine case in the context of a gag order. It was a situation where the lawyers were just, every day after court, just bombarding the press with observations about the case, with harsh criticisms about the prosecutors, about the government's witnesses, very extreme statements.
So only in very extreme cases is it appropriate for a... Bar Association to tell the attorney that it cannot comment on the case or the evidence?
No, only you're referring to the dignity of the court. I'm saying that the dignity of the court...
I want to know what your rule is, and we've talked about the dignity of the court, and which I thought was an extremely broad standard, but then you said, well, but only in extreme cases would the dignity of the court ever be affronted by comments made outside of the court, and I said, well, what other instances are there in which the bar would have an interest in promulgating a rule of this nature?
Well, the primary interest of the bar here, and as we stated in our brief, is affecting, number one, the outcome of the trial, and number two, prejudicing the jury veneer and requiring...
That sounds just like Mr. Tiger's clear and present danger.
Not at all. The second part of the standard, and this is very important, is materially different, because under Mr. Tiger's standard of Nebraska press, as long as you can get 12 jurors who can decide the case, then there's no clear and present danger. So that means through a change of venue or whatever. Under our standard, the very need to sequester a jury, or the very need for lengthy voir dire, the very need for a change of venue is itself material prejudice to an adjudicative proceeding. So in other words, the very need to rely on one of the Nebraska press less restrictive alternatives, we would submit, is a substantial likelihood of material prejudice to an adjudicative proceeding.
Kwanoff, I'm not sure that the only basis for rules like this is is prejudicing the outcome, but I must say that I read your Rule 177 to be addressed to that. It's an unusual word, materially prejudicing. I mean, prejudge. Oh. But you're telling us that that language embraces something other than causing the outcome to be prejudged.
Yes, yeah, so it's very important to look at the
it
actual...
includes dignity considerations as well.
It could in some cases, but the primary evil is...
Certainly didn't read it that way. Well, never mind the primary one.
The wording
it goes beyond that.
But the wording is substantial likelihood of material prejudice to an adjudicative proceeding rather than substantial likelihood of prejudice to the outcome. It's, for example, the type of language that the court uses in its Brady versus Maryland test about whether or not there's been reversible error from a prosecutor's failure to disclose exculpatory evidence. All one needs to do is read the adjoining rules to the Nevada rule to make absolutely clear that prejudice to the outcome is not the only kind of prejudice that the rule is dealing with. Rule 174.1, for example, prohibits lawyers from seeking to influence a prospective juror. Now, under Mr. Tiger's standard, that would not qualify under the Nebraska Press, because if you talk to that prospective juror, all you have to do is find that out from voir dire. All you have to do is continue the trial. All you have to do is have a change of venue, and there's no actual prejudice to the outcome. And so there really is an important difference. Rule 176.4 prohibits a lawyer or his employees prior to trial from investigating prospective jurors by means calculated or likely to lead to communications with prospective jurors. Again, prejudice to the proceeding, but under no Nebraska case that I know of.
Well, but he hasn't argued that his standard applies to direct communication between the lawyer and individual jurors, I don't.
Jurors in the case, but prospective jurors.
Or even individual prospective jurors.
Well, if he's saying that, I would submit, Your Honor, he's diluting the Nebraska Press standard. And that's ultimately the fear that we're concerned about. The Nebraska
Press... May I ask you this question about your influence on the proceeding by requiring a more lengthy voir dire than you would otherwise have to have, for example? Supposing it were rather clear that the prosecutor had sufficient press contact to stimulate interest that would require an extraordinary long voir dire in any event, would you then say that the defense statement had to have even more extensive voir dire, or would he then be immunized from that particular charge? I mean, is it sort of a, when is the defense counsel responsible for this additional voir dire?
Well, you're assuming that the prosecutor and the defense are talking about precisely the same thing, which...
Well, they did in this case.
No, they did not. In fact, this is an important point. What Mr. Tiger is complaining that the police were talking about primarily are the lie detector results of the police officers. What Mr. Gentile was talking about was something totally different. For example, the credibility of the other victims, the other people who had had items stolen from
the... Yes, but the voir dire didn't go into that much detail. Didn't it just ask them what you'd read about the case and what you'd heard about the case?
This particular voir dire, and we would concede, there were I believe, 10 jurors who had heard about the case. There were three who were aware that the police at one time...
Let me reframe the question. In this particular case, is there any reason to believe the voir dire was any more extensive than it would have been just based on what the police had already said to the press?
In this voir dire, it was not, and we don't quarrel with the Nevada Supreme Court's finding of no actual prejudice. But the rule is a substantial likelihood of material prejudice, and again, you have to look at it...
And if you go back to your earlier answer to one of my questions about his motive is shown by the fact he was trying to counteract the already widespread information about the case, which would seem to indicate that he wasn't requiring any more knowledge in the general community than there already was.
Well, his very admission that he was trying to counteract is not an exception. I don't know where he gets that from as an exception to the rule. It is not an exception that because you believe one side has violated the rule that you're allowed to do so.
No, it isn't that. Your argument is that his conference made it necessary to have a more extensive, or the danger was you might have to have a more extensive voir dire than otherwise.
That was the danger.
And if you already needed that extensive voir dire because of what the prosecutor and the police had said, isn't that a response to...
Well, that's not a response here. For example, jurors may have seen or recalled the particular press conference, and in fact, I should note for the court that the press conference was alluded to as early as 1 month before the trial on July 6, 1988. This is in the record, Exhibit A, to the disciplinary hearing, the Las Vegas Review-Journal. The substance, if not the actual contents of the press conference, was referred to as much as a month before trial. Now, I could imagine a voir dire going along these lines, which would be prejudice. Do any of you recognize Mr. Gentile? Yes, I do. How do you recognize him? And then going into a lengthy discussion with individual jurors about what they remember about his press conference. So, yes, there could be prejudice, new prejudice that has nothing to do with what the prosecutor had said before. But
would it have violated the rule if you had, say it was a murder case, and the defense lawyer got up to counteract the publicity, highly publicized murder case, and said, our defense is going to be alibi. We have six witnesses, I'll name them, who will testify that he was in London at the time of the alleged incident. Would that violate the rule?
No, if that's all they said, that would clearly
have the same prejudicial effect we've talked about.
Well, number one, we don't think that just that kind of a conclusory statement would have the same prejudicial effect. Number two, the rule says, notwithstanding subsection 1, so they recognize that there could be prejudice, the rule provides a safe harbor. And so there may be situations that fall within Category 3 in which in a particular case there could be prejudice, but the court made a balancing determination, for example, items in the public record, made a balancing determination guided by the First Amendment that certain types of speech should be given approval and should be allowed. Let me say in closing that in 1966, this court in Shepard against Maxwell went to great lengths to get the bar in the process of coming to where we are today, to adopt rules. At the time of Shepard against Maxwell, you had Canon 20 in a number of states, but it had really no teeth to it in substance. This court told the bars, it told the states to get serious. The rule in effect here is now in effect. Either this rule or a rule more restrictive of speech is in effect in well over 40 states, as we've detailed in our brief, responsive to the concerns that this court has raised. These rules have worked well. They've been in place for close to two decades throughout the country. There has not been serious problem with administering these rules. That's why it's taken two decades before a case has reached this court governing those rules. And we would urge the court not to turn back the clock, not to go back to the time of Shepard against Maxwell, and not to once again have a situation where lawyers are free to try their case in the press. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klonoff. Mr. Tiger, do you have rebuttal? You have 2 minutes remaining. In 1981, the ABA drafts group, as pointed out at footnote 19 of our reply brief, did say that the standard in this rule is equivalent to clear and present danger. I want to make that clear. We disagree with that, but the court, we think, should know it. We're gratified that at last it's been identified that one object of this rule is to protect the dignity of courts, language that in our respectful submission evokes the seditious libel cases of the 18th century. And were there any doubt about that, the case of In re Raggio, decided by the Nevada Supreme Court and relied on in the affirming here, deals with a prosecutor who, although he was counsel in the pending case, was disciplined because he helped to erode confidence in our system of justice. That, it seems to us, is the danger of overbreadth here. That was a press conference about a decision in the Nevada Supreme Court that followed the Witherspoon case. It is important, we believe, to note that the Levine gag order referred to here did use a clear and present danger test. That shows the workability of this. Mr. Gentile did limit himself to what he thought could be proved at the trial. He was caught between the language of 2A, can't comment on character, reputation, etc., and 3A, you can state the general nature of the claim or defense. These victim identities, after all, were in the various counts of the indictment to which he was responding. Hard to know how he could get more specific than alluding to the victims as really the wrongdoers without falling afoul of 2A. In sum, I've stood at the bar for 25 years, and I care about the bar's professionalism. I think everybody in this room does. I think that the respondent's position we submit is based on fear. Fear that the contrariety of views in the marketplace of ideas won't resolve these problems to which the court points. Fear that lawyers and judges can't draft effective protective orders. Fear that the wonder-working power of voir dire and of lawyer argument can't do it. Tiger, the case is submitted.
Thank you.